Support for this public radio podcast comes from Lindblad Expeditions, exploring nature's wild, unspoiled places aboard its ships in partnership with National Geographic. Details at 1-800-EXPEDITION.
Hello, this is Peter Jacoby for Profiles. Our guest in the studio today is Louis Ricci, a composer, pianist, guitarist, family man, and arts advocate, who serves as executive director of the Indiana Arts Commission. Now, that's a position of considerable significance. The agency gives support, financial and advocational, to the arts and artists. Well, Louis, I'm so delighted to be able to speak with you today. Can you trace how you and the IAC got together, which is when, in October of 2006?
How did the IAC and I get together? Well, first of all, I think I've had a relationship with the IAC for a while. I was director of the Columbus Area Arts Council in Columbus, Indiana for about 5 or 6 years, about a decade ago. And obviously during that time, they were a funding source. It was right on the very beginning of a regional partnership that the Arts Commission now has with 12 partners around the state, and the Columbus Area Arts Council is one of those. I was on panels to review grants for them for many years. So I was very familiar with the Arts Commission, and obviously I ran an Arts Council, which is a similar type of organization. So I guess the Arts Commission and I go back a ways. But I became the executive director. I think that's a little bit of a surprise to me, I think. I never really maybe envisioned myself professionally working as the head of a state entity for the arts. But it's been a great opportunity, and I'm glad to be associated with it now.
Well, in the process of your being selected, I would guess you probably expressed a point of view, a philosophy about the arts and the relationship of the arts to the public and the state. Can you share that, some of that, with us?
Oh, well, sure. First of all, I have to start by saying that I believe Indiana is a great art state, and you know, we're doing this interview from Indiana University today, certainly one of the foremost arts institutions of higher education in the world. My last gig before being executive director of the Arts Commission was being director of a jazz collection at the University of Idaho. And I can attest to the fact that Indiana has great jazz history. I taught a little jazz history back there, and I probably could have taught a course just from Indiana history if I needed to. So I think that that's where I start, is that Indiana is a great arts state. It has a great arts history, and it has a great arts palette of organizations and individuals currently. So part of my philosophy, I think, was I wanted to see public support in the state be commensurate with what I perceive the quality, as well as the history, as well as the identity of this state to be with regard to the arts. I think that you have an asset that has been nurtured over many years in many ways in the state and championed in many ways. And the reputation of the state has been built on it in many ways. And I think it's important that the public sector in what the policy is and how it's funded reflects really the importance of it, not only currently, but historically as well. So I think part of my philosophy started there, that I believe that this is a great place and it deserves to be supported and to have appropriate policy that the arts can flourish for more generations in the future. And I think that's where you start.
I think it's an underrated and under-understood state in terms of the arts, don't you think?
Well, I suppose, you know, middle America, and certainly Indiana is at the heart of that, and, you know, the old Crossroads of America thing reigns fairly big in this state because a lot of arts not only originated here, but it came through the state. For instance, in jazz history, you had the migration of jazz musicians from New Orleans when the scene sort of died out there to Chicago, which was the next place. So everybody passed through Indiana because you can't really go from New Orleans to Chicago up the river without getting off the boat and going across land, and you go through Indiana. So not only a lot of arts have sprung from the soil here and the people here, but also a lot of arts passed through here. You know, you think about theater history and the circus in Peru, Indiana. You think about jazz history and Jeanette Records in Richmond, Indiana. You can go on and on with music instrument companies like, you know, Selmer and Kimball. And the history here is very rich. And perhaps I've often thought, you know, Indiana is a place where maybe societally or socially in history, you know, you're in the middle of a cornfield for the most part, or middle of a rural setting. And the arts spring from people as something to do, as a social element. And it becomes an important thing because you are somewhat isolated in a sense. But also you have the big city influence that came through here and influenced people and gave them vision for their lives, what it could be. And the arts are a powerful thing in that way, draw people to them. And I think that happened in the state a lot as well.
You obviously have a passion. How do you feel the IAC, the commission, fits into this picture? What is its job as you see it?
Well, I think one of the great things about having public funding in the arts is it becomes, I call it a gatekeeper for quality and accountability. You know, you want to have, you want your state to be known for arts, but you want it to be known for a quality of arts as well. And you need some mechanism to raise organizations and individuals up to some sort of level of quality. Public money does that. I mean, we have a very rigorous adjudication process by which we panel organizations and individuals before we grant the money. That brings up the quality of what goes on here. It also brings up the accountability. Obviously, when you have public money invested in organizations or in individuals, you have to be accountable back to every taxpayer. And therefore, we are as a funding source, and we do that. That's not our only job, but that's certainly part of our job. As a funding source, we're a much more rigorous entity as far as demanding accountability and quality than other funding sources might be. So I think we raise the bar, and that's the importance of public money being in there because other funding sources would not necessarily want or demand the level of quality or accountability that we demand because of the public investment and our accountability back to every citizen of the state. So I think that's one of the great roles of public money. And obviously, a certain level of public money is therefore necessary to attract people to apply for it. I mean, if the money is meager, the hoops are fairly rigorous, and you want the monies to be commensurate with the hoops that you expect people to go through to get it, or you're not going to attract people to apply for that public money. So that's one of the real important things that I think that the IAC provides is a standard in not only the artistic quality realm, but in the accountability realm for organizations and individuals. And those things are important to ensure quality, but also quality over time, that things are enduring, that things are managed well, that monies even from the private sector are then invested well in the not-for-profit industry of the arts here.
What is the level of money that you get from the state?
Well, that just increased, which is a really great thing. Our budget for this coming fiscal year is a little bit over $5 million. And so a bit over $4 million of that is state money. We increased about 30% over last year, a combination of some legislated money and some contracted money with another state agency. That's really a wonderful thing. That's a significant increase for this state or any organization, really, to be able to have its major source of funding increase at that level.
Well, I do remember it as being much lower when I was on the Indiana Arts Commission. But we're now, what, at about 75 or 80 cents per person in the state or what?
We are currently about up in the 70s somewhere, which is good. But the national average is about $1.14 per citizen of state money invested. So we're still in the bottom half of the states, which, you know, I have vision that I'd like to be a leader at some point in the state and really be the standard that people measure themselves against rather than us measuring against another standard somewhere. And I think that's possible in that state and in this state. And I think that we have the quality here in order to do that. So I believe very strongly in that.
Now, as such, I guess advocacy, selling the arts, becomes another important part of the commission.
Well, absolutely.
Aside from funding.
Well, I think we're, you know, part of our job is to articulate a case for the arts. And that's what basically advocacy is. I think, you know, advocacy is basically relationship building. And it's relationship building with governmental officials, legislators, our governor, and individuals and institutions in our state, be those for-profit businesses or universities. It is a way of articulating and positioning a case for the arts, for its value to every citizen, to the economy, to the identity, and to the aspirations of a citizenry as well. And that's really what advocacy is about. And it takes relationship building and taking the relationships that we have in the arts community and expanding those relationships and applying those relationships to other systems that are here in our state and other entities that are here in our state.
Is that how you get around the argument of those who say, well, we always need to cut taxes, hold down government expenses, and there are so many things that government has to do? Are the arts really that critical on the list of necessities?
Well, you know, I'm a firm believer also in the fact that no matter how small your budget is or how big your budget is, it comes down to priorities. And what are the priorities of a people? What are the aspirations of people? And how do you want to apply those things most efficiently and effectively to them? I guess I never think of it as an either-or proposition. Part of advocacy is showing how the interrelationship of things and how one thing affects another and how it's important to have investment in one area in order to have growth not only in that area but in another area. For instance, you know, it's very important, and our administration has been very proactive in trying to pursue job creation in the state of Indiana. Well, part of a formula for job creation, first of all, the arts do provide a lot of jobs in this state or in any state. I mean, the arts are a vital piece of the economy. But beyond what they do in creating specific jobs in the arts, they are also very important in attracting not only businesses that want to be in this state, but individuals who want to be in this state. In other words, when a business is, or an industry is looking to locate or to develop in the state of Indiana, those decision makers are looking at a palette of things that they believe are going to be good for them to prosper. And part of their formula for prospering is to attract the right employees into positions, especially when we think of white collar industries that we would like to build on in the state, biotech and other things, but also any kind of industry. They're looking for essential qualities of education and life that are important to that. Well, the arts are very squarely in those things to provide the level of education, the level of community life, the level of social interaction, et cetera, that are really required by any business to be successful. And to retain and to attract quality people, it's one of the things that people look at. Do I want to live in this place? And what do the arts say about the place that I'm living in? Or we were just talking a little bit before the interview. I have a son who is in college. Well, a lot of young people especially are looking for a certain complement of things to be attractive to an area to be educated in or to work in. And certainly the artistic climate is one of the biggest things of a new generation that people are looking for why they're going to work in a place. It's becoming less about the job itself and more about the place that the job is and what kind of quality of life that offers for an individual. So the arts become a very crucial piece of that as well.
Well, I do want to get in a few minutes into your family background and your own history. But you have mentioned, or you've certainly suggested, your enthusiasm for jazz as one art form. And I want to get to some music.
Okay.
And I know that one of your favorites is Hoagy.
Hoagy Carmichael.
Certainly Indiana all the way, isn't it? What would you like to have us hear by Hoagy Carmichael, and tell us why the selection?
Well, one of the things I requested was The Nearness of You, which is a great Hoagy Carmichael ballad, but done by Roy Hargrove, which is a great young flugelhornist, trumpeter, jazz trumpeter, just one of the most, reaches me on an emotional level. He's very expressive. He can play one note and just kill you type of thing, you know. It's not only his, his prowess as a technician, which is incredible, but emotion.
Kill you in a good way.
Yeah, right. His emotion that he puts in with playing is just phenomenal. So if we could hear a little bit of that, that'd be wonderful.
Let's listen to The Nearness of You by Hoagy Carmichael. We have just heard some Hoagy Carmichael music, the choice of our guest, Louis Ricci, the executive director of the Indiana Arts Commission, and one of his favorites in the realm of the arts is certainly the jazz area, and Hoagy is among those composers. Let's talk a little bit about your past. It has been rich in different experiences. And I see that actually you studied biology as an undergraduate. So how did we get from biology to the arts?
Oh, well, let me see. I've played piano since I was 4 years old. So I've had this, love affair with an art form since I was a kid. I can't remember not playing. And but I also always had this other kind of side of myself. I was a very good student growing up and had, pretty good analytical skills, I think. And when I got into high school, I was involved in, choir and band and all of those things musically. But I also really liked the sciences and sort of found it challenging. So when I went to college at Bucknell University in Pennsylvania, I decided to be a biology major. But I always had the arts part of me sort of gnawing at the back of my persona, saying, you love this too. You want to do this. So I received the biology degree and even started graduate school in ecology at the University of California at Davis. And at that time, I was also pursuing music pretty heavily, as kind of a songwriter, popular music. And I felt that my voice was sort of the weakest part of what I did. So I decided to go get some voice lessons. And I happened to take lessons from the woman who was the conductor, the artistic director of the local chorale. And she was also a high school music teacher. She was also a graduate of the opera program, master's degree here at Indiana. Mm-hmm. And her husband ran the artist series in the local auditorium in Davis, California, University of California, Davis. And they asked me to be on the board of directors. And I started thinking, you know what? This might not be a bad career choice for me because I'm around the things I love, music and the arts. But it's also taking my analytical skills as well and my scientific training and all of that certainly sharpened those analytical skills. And so one day I was talking to Rachel Day Kessler, was her name. She was Rachel Day when she was here at Indiana. And I said, you know, I'm thinking about arts administration. She said, well, you might look at Indiana University. She was an alum. She said, the arts are very strong there. I wouldn't be surprised if they had a good program. And sort of the rest is history.
My goodness. So from there then, I mean, I see in your background you have arts administration experience. You have museum experience or collection experience. Publicity promotion experience.
Mm-hmm. Fundraising.
Fundraising.
I spent a number of
years. So all of this has come together.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's maybe one of the reasons I took this job as well is I felt I had a really good complement of skills for it, as well as, I've really been a generalist when it comes down to the world of the arts, even though, music is my personal love and passion. I've worked with museums, theater companies, dance companies. There's really broadcasting. So there's not like an area that I'm not comfortable with or at least knowledgeable of to some degree. And I think, that's required of a person in this position to have love and some experience in really every art form. I've also, as a person, I've done silk screening and bronze casting and blown glass and done a little bit of musical theater and you name it. I've tried it. I'm just kind of that type of person. So even though it may not be my my forte or my long suit, it is certainly I love really all of the arts and would like to think I could do them if I applied myself to nearly anything, but I'll only say that very quietly because whatever.
Well, at the very least, you're an adventurer.
That's right.
An experimenter. Now, you worked here at the station.
I did. I worked for WFIU when I was graduated from the arts administration program here with a master's degree. The next 3 years, I worked at WFIU as the marketing and promotion director, though many years ago. I wouldn't even say how many. It was a great, great time in my life. I think I met you at that time, yeah. Peter. So, and, talking about my history, I think we would be remiss if we didn't say that you have a pretty strong history with the Indiana Arts Commission. You were a commissioner from Bloomington, and then you served as the chair of the Indiana Arts Commission for a number of years as well. So you have quite a relationship as well as a passion for the organization.
Well, I do, and I'm glad that you're in charge of it now because certainly needed a push in the right direction. Now, let's imagine that you're back at this station working and they've given you a job as an on-the-air announcer. And so you're going to announce another one of your favorites so that it can be played and heard by our listeners. And I understand that Cole Porter is also on your list.
That's right. For a while, I worked for the Cole Porter Centennial. Here in the state of Indiana when he got to the 100 year mark. Of course, he wasn't around for that. But this is Too Darn Hot, which is just a sizzling Porter tune done by Ella Fitzgerald and a very enduring one. I think this recording has aged really, really well.
Well, let's do an official introduction.
Oh,
you as the announcer.
I'd like to treat people with a definitive rendition of Too Darn Hot by the great Ella Fitzgerald.
It It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. I'd like to sup with my baby tonight. Refill the cup with my baby tonight. I'd like to sup with my baby tonight. Refill the cup with my baby tonight. But I ain't up to my baby tonight, 'cause it's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. I'd like to cool with my baby tonight. And pitch the woo with my baby tonight. I'd like to coo with my baby tonight. And pitch the woo with my baby tonight.
We have just heard Ella Fitzgerald, Too Darn Hot, Cole Porter, as introduced by our guest in the studio, Louis Rickey. At the Indiana Arts Commission, Louis, you have to deal with various publics and with colleagues and with centers of power. I mean, you've got your staff, you've got your commissioners, you've got your governor, you've got your legislature, you've got various communities around the state and various communities within those communities. How do you bring all that together in a philosophy that works, that somehow has a unity to it?
I mean, that's a great question, because as you might imagine, all of those entities bring a different set of priorities and a different set of perspectives to the table. I think you always start on the things that you agree on. And because of the arts are so valuable to, you know, our society and our state in a variety of ways, you can always start there. I mean, first of all, there's an intrinsic value to the art that I think that everyone believes in. When I was director of the jazz collections, as you can imagine, there's not many jazz collections in the United States. There's about a half a dozen of them. And so you get to know the world pretty – it's a pretty small world. You get to know it pretty quickly. And so in a fairly short amount of time, I was able to forge some good relationships with the other archives, and we started some joint projects. And two of those archives are the Smithsonian and the Library of Congress, both in Washington, D.C. And also I was funded a bit by some federal money. So I ended up going to Washington, D.C. a lot. And one day I was had a couple meetings at the Smithsonian, was on the Mall, you know. And so I was turned around looking down at the Capitol building, and the obvious dawned on me. And the obvious was that the Mall leading to the Capitol building, which is our seat of governmental decision-making power, we've lined it with our culture, right? I mean, you look at all the museums that line the Mall, and you've got the Hirshhorn and the National Museum of Art, and you've got the Museum of the American Indian, and you've got the Art National Archives. You can just go through it. You know, there's some technology, but it's mostly humanities and arts that line that Mall. You know what that says? That says that we all recognize and we all believe that it's somehow a mark of a great society and a great civilization is its culture. And when we wanted to say, what are we known for? What are we putting in the window of our store? Say, this is what we are as a people. This is who we are. This is what we believe in. This is what is valuable to us. That's what we've put there. You know, we haven't put the Department of Agriculture there. Not that I think the Department of Agriculture isn't important, because it is. But we say that this is really what our identity is. And this is really the expression of who we are. And I think everyone believes that at some level. They have to recognize that, because it is so infused in what it is to be human. And I think, you know, good leadership does less of dictating and more articulating what is there in a way that people could then bring it back to themselves and own it in some way. And it can resonate with what they believe and what is important to them. And I think that's what you really need to do. And when you take all of those entities, you have things like commissioners who are volunteers, who are there because of what they believe. You have institutions who are based on a belief set. I mean, the only reason to have a not-for-profit institution is because it does some social good. It's based on a belief set. You know, government and what it does for people is basically based on a belief set, why public money should be invested in something. So I think you come back to what people believe. And you listen and you articulate, you assemble that and you rearticulate it so it resonates with those belief sets in an appropriate way. But I think it's all based on what people believe.
Well, if so many of us believe in the importance of the arts and humanities, then why are they so low on the list of priorities when it comes to government support? Politicians try to avoid even talking about the arts, lest they, by bringing them up, there would be all kinds of opposition put forward.
Politicians have a very difficult task in front of them because, you know, they're faced with societal needs that that are very concrete and very real and have real dollar signs attached to them. And so, you know, politicians always want to, you know, do we fill potholes or do we, you know, when we invest in a cultural organization? And I think part of the challenge is that, you know, cultural things not only are immediately valuable, but there's long-term value to societies involved in supporting its culture and its identity. And a lot of times politicians are faced with having to solve short-term crises, and it's harder to invest in the longer-term view of a society and a people. And I think because of that, that's somewhat of the difficulty. So you have to put things also in immediate terms for them. But I think part of the importance of public support is the long haul of where a society is going and what it wants to be, not only this year, but 10 years or 10 generations down the line. And sometimes it's difficult to have politicians look at that longer term because their realities are so much shorter terms, be that their term of office or the needs that are facing them immediately. So I think that's part of the challenge of it. I don't think it's always necessarily simply the prioritization of it. I think that there is a good belief set out there that they are very important. I think some of it is just the immediate decisions that they have to make as opposed to the long term.
It's getting around that either-or argument, mm-hmm. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And showing how it is a part of the immediate solution as well as the long-term health of an economy, of a society, of a people.
I want to get back a little bit more to some of your enthusiasms. For instance, jazz. What is it about jazz that so excites you?
First of all, I love the history of jazz because of the fact that it's so American in that it grew out of a lot of different people, a lot of different cultures. I mean, it's based in, you know, African-American culture here in the United States, first and foremost. But it grew and is what it is because of the influences of so many different art forms and people. So you have classical music and you have theater music and you have Tin Pan Alley and you have blues and you have folk music, all of that, classical music, it all has been part of an organic growth of what jazz, you know, really is. And so it's reflective, I think, of who we are as a people. That being said, it's also something that thrived and tested and was, in essence, some sort of conversation and improvisation based in some set of rules that people could easily grab and then have a conversation within. And maybe that's one of the reasons that it was like a magnet that it glued all of these other musical entities within it because it could embrace many things in that conversation. And then I think it's fun. It's fun to listen to. It's fun to see the personalities of artists come through that. And it's been one of our great contributions to the world. I mean, you know, getting back to the importance to our American economy, I mean, our culture is one of our biggest exports, you know. And really, when you talk about American exports into the world, you got to talk about jazz, because jazz infiltrated and infused the entire world, and then also embraced a lot of those cultures back into it. So I think jazz is a pretty exciting art form from that standpoint.
So if it's so exciting to you, why'd you leave this job in Moscow, Idaho, where you were so directly involved with the history of the form?
I don't know that I interviewed for this job on a whim. It wasn't quite an impulse item, but there was a bit of that to it, I think. And I had never really thought about being, you know, the director of an arts commission for a state. But then the only reason I considered it was because it was the state of Indiana and because of my affection for this place.
You wanted to come back here?
Well, I mean, I think that's part of it. It's interesting. You know, I've done now arts-related things in Pennsylvania and Idaho, and I was here in Indiana. And as I went to these other states, not saying that what they were doing was great, because there was lots of great things, but I never really found, I suppose, the passion and the commitment that I knew of as Indiana when I went to these to the other places. And so there was always a piece of me that was attracted back to here, because I think the commitment of people and the passion for what was going on here. And so I applied for it a bit on a whim, because thinking, well, you know, I would actually consider doing that. And then when I came back to interview for the job, I was a little concerned, I guess that would be the right word, of where the arts were in the state when I came back, as opposed to when I left. I was here, you know, a decade ago being the director of an arts council, and sort of knew where the state was in terms of push towards arts education being important and other things. And I felt like that in the 10 years that I was gone, that the state had not advanced significantly and in some ways had regressed a little bit on some of the fronts that we all knew were important back then and we really wanted to make some progress on. So I think I came back also because I felt like this is a place that I love. This is something that I believe in, and I think I could make a difference. And I think anybody who's going to be involved in the public realm has to think that in order to be that, because it's not an easy thing to do, and there's always a lot of uphill climbs ahead of you in order to make some significant progress. So I think you have to have sort of a baseline love and commitment to the place and to what you're doing, and a belief that you can change something for the better. Or I don't think you really have any point being in public service, truthfully. I mean, that's my personal philosophy. And I think those things kind of lined up for me on a personal level, and I decided it was something worth doing and something that I think I could help and that I believed in.
One of the issues that you mention prominently in your mind is arts education, the importance of that, and how that fits in to the Indiana Arts Commission picture.
Well, first of all, you know, I'm a true believer in as you can tell by my past, you know, having a degree in science and in arts management and being, you know, a trained musician and all of that. You know, I believe that education and learning different subjects brings and develops people in different ways, and that there is a place for all of it, and it's important. And I think that – I hope that I'm a fairly well-rounded individual, and I think part of that is because I've had training and education from a number of different vantage points. So first of all, I think inherently that the presence of arts education is important in our public schools because it develops people in a unique and important way of thinking creatively.
And hasn't that place declined?
Well, certainly. I mean, I, you know, and part of this is happenstance and where our society as a whole has gone, where our economy has gone, where our position in the world has gone, the translation of one generation to another generation. I think there's been a lot of factors that has pushed it. And obviously, we have an emphasis on a national level towards science and technology, math and English, reading skills, writing skills, basic math skills, and technology skills. And I think that's all extremely important. But that's only a piece of what has fueled our society and our economy over time. I mean, you know, we've been fueled by our creativity and then have taken that creativity and built economy and processes and systems and businesses and industries on top of the creativity. But the creativity ultimately is the thing that has fueled our economy. Make no mistake about it. I mean, why the world has copied our systems and our economy is because they've basically copied our creativity. I mean, I really believe that on some very fundamental level. And if we aren't training people in the rudiments of creative thinking and the tools of creativity, which are the arts, what is going to fuel those things in the future? You can't be building technology on top of whose creativity? Will it be someone else's creativity? And I think the great society that we have and the great wealth that we've had as a nation primarily comes from the creative soul of our people, and then how that's been interpreted into the commercial realm, you know, into the economic realm. But without that creativity, who's going to be doing that in the future?
So how do we pass this idea along to boards of education and superintendents?
Well, you know, where those folks are mandated to be at this point in time is to produce on another level. And I think that the arts are also very fundamental in that. In other words, the creative training interprets into kids that will have better analytical skills, better reading skills, better math skills, all of that. As a matter of fact, you know, there's a lot of information that's just beginning to be correlated, come out, that shows that, you know, kids that have more than a year of arts or music training in high school do better on their SATs in verbal and in math, and have a better graduation rate, et cetera, et cetera. So the arts also influence that other piece of it as well. And truthfully, where schools are at the moment, you need to show administrators, decision makers, that this helps the ends that they're faced with being accountable for currently. But in doing that, you can also champion the arts in themselves and what they are for well-rounded education and developing students. And so I think it's always taking people where they are and helping lead them to where you want them to be and where they need to be at the same time. And I think that's what we're faced with in schools right now, is they're accountable at a certain level for certain subjects more than others. And we have to be a vital part of helping them be accountable for those things, but at the same time reestablishing the importance of what the arts are in the educational mix and priorities and essential education of any human being.
We don't have too much time left, but I notice sort of hidden in your resume is the word composer.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's true.
And you mentioned it earlier, too. I guess I did in my introduction. Tell us about you as a composer. What have you composed, and do you still do that?
I consider myself really a songwriter more than – I think songwriting is sort of an art where, you know, words and music come together in some way. And so I've done a bunch of that in my life. I love it. I love songwriters. You know, we're talking about Hoagy and Cole here, and you know, both of them. You know, obviously Cole Porter did all of his own music and lyrics with it. Hoagy did some of that and teamed with lyricists as well. But you know, Hoagy Carmichael was kind of really the first real kind of singer-songwriter in America. You know, he did record a lot of his own tunes and sort of had a persona and that sort of thing. And then Cole Porter was one of the great masters of both the written word and the musical line. So so I have a lot of admiration for people who do it well. I'd like to think that I've progressed in my life and I do it decently and like I still do it, like to do it more. FIU listeners might know me for a little bit more, don't know it's me. A Moment of Science, that kind of ethereal music behind it. Mark Scarce, who worked for me, who was a composition major, and I sort of wrote that, and I played it many years ago, and it has endured on this station.
We hear
so,
your
so
music.
So you hear me every day, several times a day, playing a DX7 version of some kind of New Age ethereal music, which isn't really my thing, but it was what that project called for, and I got pressed into service, so...
Have you had any of your works published?
I've written a number of songs, and I just have been playing recently one of my favorites, which is called Dry Spell, which is kind of a tune about drought and a sort of lost love at the same time, sort of meshed together. So that's one of my favorite ones that I'm currently sort of, you have little love affairs with things that you do, and currently that's one of mine.
As we head out from this interview, as we say goodbye, let's play some more music. Let you introduce something that we're going to listen to as...
I think I've picked out another Hoagy Carmichael tune, Georgia on My Mind, which is extremely famous Carmichael tune done by Mildred Bailey. And Millie Bailey was a jazz and popular singer. She became known actually as the Rocking Chair Lady because she popularized Rocking Chair, another Carmichael tune. She actually gave Bing Crosby his start in the entertainment world because her brother was a partner of Bing's in making music. But anyhow, so I thought I would play a little bit of Millie Bailey doing Georgia on My Mind.
So with that on our mind, let me say that we have been talking to Louis Ricci, who is the executive director of the Indiana Arts Commission and who is a true lover, advocate, pursuer of the arts. We're delighted to have had you with us, and we're going to listen now to some Hoagy Carmichael and Georgia on My Mind. This is Peter Jacoby. Thank you very much for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in October of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.